Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I will be flying solo tonight as your host, Brian C. Wood. Chad has the evening off, cavorting with his young child, being a loving and caring, devoted father. And our good friend T. Bob Hebert is somewhere out in the wilderness of God's country trying to figure out what LSU football is going to do in the coming season. So that just leaves me here to talk about the weird, wild, and wacky week of Comic-Con 2018. So generally, every year, me and Chad sit here and we do about an hour, hour and 15 minutes of conversation about Comic-Con and about what's coming up, and then we do about another hour after Comic-Con to kind of recap and go over what happened and all the details and how crazy everything got. Well, this year, obviously, we had Jim come on prior to the convention starting to really give us a solid preview of what was going to happen and what was to come. We then had the convention and the load of news, both expected and unexpected, that came out of it. We also had some unexpected box office receipts to look at as well for this weekend. So what I'm going to do here tonight is kind of talk about my thoughts, and I'm sure Chad will give his thoughts the next time we're together, about Comic-Con 2018 and all the weird, wild, and wacky news. So let's dive into it. So the first major thing that I want to get into, because I don't really want to get into too much of the TV stuff. I mean, obviously the DC television universe had a huge presence, as they have for about the last 4 years. Obviously, new news about Supergirl and Arrow and Flash and Black Lightning and Legends of Tomorrow and all of those four or five shows that are going on in the CW, they all had a presence, obviously, at Comic-Con. As we mentioned on our preview podcast, clearly there was no presence from HBO, so there was no Game of Thrones and there was no Westworld presence at this year's convention. But really what we are is a movies podcast anyway. So what we're going to focus on is the movies. And the first major thing that we want to talk about when we talk about films at Comic-Con 2018 is, the debut of the Glass trailer. Obviously, M. Night Shyamalan is one of the most controversial filmmakers in Hollywood. He's one of those guys who went to director's jail for a little while, following movies like Lady in the Water, which I actually really like, The Happening, and some other, The Last Airbender, which was his last real foray into whitewashing and cult and blockbuster filmmaking. But obviously, he had partnered with Jason Blum to put out a very, micro budget horror movie called Split, and that opened in January of 2017 and just wowed the world and set all kind of box office records because A, it was a really good movie, B, as is the case always with Shyamalan, his films are completely dependent upon the twist. If the twist works, the film works. If the twist doesn't work, movie generally doesn't work. So it had a twist that worked and tied into some previous work of his. And C, it was in the middle of January. And if you put in a good movie in January, put out a good movie in January, I think we've pretty much established that, the audience will come. So obviously, at the tail end of that movie, Split, we got a tease for when several of the characters from Unbreakable, which was his superhero film before superhero films that he made and released in 2000, showed up. And so because Split made so much money, we knew we were going to get a film called Glass, which is the Avengers for his little horror universe that he has going on there, with Unbreakable and Split. Those two casts together will merge. He will bring in Sarah Paulson, she of American Horror Story and American Crime Story fame, and a great all-around actress. And we're going to get that movie in January of 2019. And he had a panel where he didn't give away very much at Comic-Con. You know, they gave the number of personalities that James McAvoy's character will inhabit in the film. They talked about, you know, Sarah Paulson's character being a psychiatrist who majors or specializes in people with basically superhero disorder, where they believe that they are superheroes when in fact they are not. And the trailer that dropped basically set your plot points up that it'll be Bruce Willis's character versus Glass again, and this time Glass is gonna have you know, obviously the Beast. He's gonna try and recruit McAvoy's Beast to come out and play and help him in his quest. The movie looks like it has a slightly bigger budget than what Split had, but not as big of a budget as something like, say, Last Airbender had. It'll be interesting to see what the twist is here to this film. The footage all looked great. I think that if you're a huge fan of the original film, I think you were pleasantly surprised to see the stinger at the end of Split. And I think you're going to be really excited for this film. I think Sam Jackson's going to really delve in and give it his all. And I really think Sam Jackson's going to fall in and give it his all. And I think that Bruce Willis is going to try and deliver a good performance as well. We all know McAvoy will hit it out of the park. He was a one-man tour de force in Split. So I don't think we have any issues there. I think that people just want to see this film, and they want to see monster versus monster action, or hero versus villain action, and hero versus monster action. And I think this film will definitely deliver on this. And I think the budget is still constrained enough, and Blum is going to keep Shyamalan in check enough to where he's not going to run completely wild, and he's not going to flood his frame with too many things. And I don't think his price tag will be too expensive. So they'll be right in line with the Blumhouse model of, you know, making a lot of money. So it'll be interesting to see what he does with that and how that film is received when it comes out in January of 2019. Like I said, I was really impressed with the trailer. I'm someone who is okay on Shyamalan. I think The Sixth Sense was... the twist was so revolutionary for the time that he was in that I think it kind of just shakes you to your core. And I think it resonated with audiences at that point in time in history. But I think a lot of his subsequent stuff really does hinge on the twist, and the twist very rarely ever works. As I said, I'm more of a fan, honestly, of the Lady in the Water. That's the film I think people have one of the bigger problems with, because he basically makes himself the star of it. The twist involves him because he appears in all of his movies. So, I mean, I think he's out of director's jail, clearly. He has a fresh slate. Most of the sins that he committed are a decade old. You know, I'm speaking as somebody who likes maybe one of his films, not all of them by any stretch, but I've seen pretty much his entire catalog. I think he's a brilliant filmmaker under the right constraints. There are plenty of filmmakers you can go down the list and say, well, they would be better off if, you know, this happened, or they would be better off if that happened. And I think in Shyamalan's case, he's like, you know, someone like Terry Gilliam, or someone like Ridley Scott, someone who works better when you constrain the budget, when you put restrictions on them. When you plug them into this narrow line of focus and you say you cannot get out of this line, I think they perform better than when they do when they're given free rein, go as wild, go as crazy, money's no object. And then, you know, they do it, and then the budget balloons up to $250, $300 million on what should be a $125 million pitch, $100 million movie, and, you know, you're losing money. So I'm anxious to see what the budget on this is. I'm interested to see what the reception is, and I am looking forward to the arrival of Glass. Now, let's move on to one of the more interesting things that came out of Comic-Con. That would be a movie that Chaz talked about a great deal, and I've talked a bit about a great deal, and a movie that I have booed every time that it is played on a trailer in front of a film that I have seen, and that would be Venom. Sony had their panel for Venom on Friday night of Comic-Con. So if you go and you do a broad timeline search for Venom reactions from Friday night, you're going to see some cool, upbeat, positive ones. You know, I like the things we get out of the panel were basically that, you know, they can totally spin out a major Venom verse out of this movie if this one works. Tom Hardy took the role because he wanted to make a movie his kid could see, and or because his kid's a huge Venom fan, and basically the only other thing we learned was that it's not going to be Carnage. Carnage is not in, maybe in the film, may not be in the film, but that it is, you know, there is another symbiote who is the major villain in this movie that Roz Ahmed is playing. Those were the information that we got out of this film. Again, Sony did this tap dance around where they kind of hinted at Tom Holland being in the movie in some capacity, or the door being open for him to meet Spider-Man down the road. I will again go on record as saying that, you know, Kevin Feige will literally roll over and die before that ever happens. That Tom Holland Spider-Man is in the MCU. Therefore, any movie that he appears in will tie back into the MCU. And I have no inclination or no reason to believe that Sony, that Disney wants, or that Marvel wants anything to do with a Venom movie that's made by Avi Arad and with Tom Hardy as Venom. Marvel has no creative control over the way that they're portraying Venom. As Chad and I have spoken many, many times on this podcast, we think it's a stupid idea because you're taking Venom off the table. Now let's get to some of the footage reaction. So there's a very fine line when you're reading Comic-Con reactions, because you're not actually, you know, I'm not actually in the room. So I have to rely on the people that are in the room, like Jim, like Evan, you know, Haley Fouch. I'm reliant on other people who are in the room to give me a sense of what the footage was. If you do a general timeline search, the implication in some of the footage is that you see Venom eat a guy's head. This is the scene that you see at the very end of the latest trailer that we got, where he says, "We are Venom," in his little Tom Hardy voice. That was the other thing we found out from the panel, is that Tom Hardy did the Venom lines first, and then had them fed to him in an earpiece when they were filming the scenes where the two talk. But the you get a generalized view, and it's like Venom. I just watched Venom eat a guy's head, and then you read others, and it's like, well, it's implied, it's not shown. There's a huge difference there. You see Venom eating a guy's head. It's really cool. That lends to the grittiness and the grime and the you know, veracity and violence that you would want from a Venom movie. However, with, you know, Hardy saying that he wants to lean more towards something his kid could watch, it tends to make me think that we're heading toward a PG-13 movie, in which case you can't show Venom eating a guy's head. The reactions were mixed. There were some people who were like, you absolutely have to take the Venom movie seriously now. This footage rocked. It was awesome. It was amazing. I totally buy everything that's going on. The action scenes work, yada yada. And then you had others like, yeah, it's a 90s movie. You know, I'm going to see it, but I can't promise you it's going to work. And, you know, that's the generalized feeling that I get. It's that, like, while it's cool that the Venom design is, you know, similar to what's in the comic books, and that some of the dialogue and some of the shot selection feels very much like a comic book movie out of the 90s. And when you have this production team, when you have this creative force behind your film, I can totally understand why you end up with a film that looks like it fits into the late 90s, early 2000s period of superhero movies. I've said on many occasions on this podcast that I'm not sold on this film for a number of reasons, but my biggest issue with it is that it takes Venom out of Disney's and Marvel's playbook, their toolbox. Marvel can't utilize Venom. They can't have Eddie Brock show up in the high school where Peter Parker is. Can't do it. He can't run into Eddie Brock in Italy, in England, when he's out globetrotting on his adventures in Far From Home. He can't do it, because now you've got this Tom Hardy version of the character that exists. Now, Jim Bavida from IGN, our good friend, had posited a theory many moons ago about the idea that maybe that the Venom movie takes place in the aftermath of, you know, the Homecoming movies. That takes place sometime later, after the Tom Holland Spider-Man has grown up. But I don't, again, that would have to place it in MCU canon, and I don't think Marvel's going to want to do that. There are also always going to be the concerns about placing Venom in a movie where he basically has to be, you know, an anti-hero, with someone who's worse than Venom being the villain, and to do all of that without, you know, Spider-Man. It looks like the route that they're going to take is basically to say that Ra's al Ghul's character believes that the symbiotes are something similar to what Killerich wanted Extremis to be. Something to help evolve the human race beyond what it currently is and make it basically a superhuman or metahuman, whatever you want to call it. And so he believes that, and they said this in the trailer, that the symbiotes are the key to human evolution. And so essentially he's trying to bind symbiotes to host to try and find, you know, to see if his theories are correct. And the problem is that, just like with Killerich injecting Extremis into people and then blowing up, you know, these symbiotes aren't taking to some of these hosts and they're dying. So, you know, it's just, and you know, you could say it's the same as Corey Stahl, Yellow Jacket, in the original Ant-Man movie, where he's trying to perfect Ben's technology and he kills goats and eventually, you know, figures out that he needs human subjects. You know, that's how they're going to get around the Spider-Man part of the origin. How they're going to say, where they're going to say, or how they're going to say that he found the symbiote, my guess is there'll probably be some kind of meteor shower that'll hit, and, you know, that his lab will contain a crash site, and they'll find the symbiote, yada yada. But the film itself is a bad idea. And the execution of it doesn't look great. I'm extremely happy that Robert Foster is going to do this. He's going to make some money, and then he's going to go do Zombieland sequel, which he should have done ages ago. You know, because that movie's awesome and funny, and you can do it fairly easily and cheaply. But I just don't think this movie is a good idea. And there was nothing that I read and nothing that I saw out of the San Diego Comic-Con footage or panel that got me super duper happy and excited and thrilled and and pumped up for a Venom movie. I think some heads were turned. I think some people who were skeptical got a little bit interested, but overall I don't think that they had the overwhelmingly aggressively positive reaction that they needed or were hoping for with this film. And so it'll be interesting to see where they go with the marketing. Clearly they didn't drop a new trailer, I don't believe. They just or maybe they did. Maybe they did drop, I think they did drop a trailer, actually. But they did do the panel, and they did show the extended sequences, and they got an okay reaction from it. And I think that's going to be the major takeaway, is that, you know, it was kind of a shrug. And you can't have a shrug when you're coming out of Comic-Con and your movie's kind of a dubious prospect. Now, I think the thing that will help Venom is its release window. You're talking about an October movie in a dead period between the heat of the summer and the rush of the holiday season. So it might have some legs, especially if it's good, that nerds will go out and see it and support it. If it's bad, it will die on the vine, Jonah Hex style. And I don't think that that's exactly what they're aiming for. But again, I don't really think that they got the reaction that they were looking for or wanting coming out of the Comic-Con panel for them. The next thing that we want to move to is some rather disappointing news that came out of Comic-Con on late Friday night, early Saturday morning. Disney released Disney, not Marvel. And this is something I want to emphasize. Disney, not Marvel, put out a press release announcing that they had fired James Gunn from the production of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. The reason for this that was given were some tweets that Gunn had posted from 2008, 2009, 2010, where he was making jokes about, to some extent, pedophilia and rape. Having read the screenshot of the tweets, I don't think that they're anything that a stand-up comedian in a nightclub who bombs has ever done. I think if you go back and you look at some very, very, very successful comedians now, some of their earlier sets probably contain some crass, crude, vulgar, inappropriate jokes like this, quote-unquote jokes. I think that Disney did what they thought was best, and Gunn certainly understood it. But I want to stress a very important thing that needs to be looked at here. It was not Marvel who put out the press release. Marvel didn't fire James Gunn. Alan Horn, president of distribution, and probably Bob Iger made the call to fire him. And I think that's important because I don't think that Feige and Marvel wanted to do it. I think it was probably Feige and Marvel's preference to fight through the firestorm. And in a day and age where, you know, the news cycle turns over every 6 hours, not even every 12 or 24 hours, every 6 hours now the news cycle changes over, the hope, I think, for them was that you could weather this storm and ride it out and that everything would be okay. You know, the movie wasn't supposed to come out for another you know, 24 months. It was supposed, or 22 months. It was supposed to come out in May of 2020, and you know, that would have been a sufficient amount of time, you know, for people to forget about this story. So I think that Marvel was kind of at a place where they were kind of hoping, honestly, that this thing would kind of blow over and they could fight through the PR storm. I think the problem was that Alan Horn and Bob Iger, having just gone through this politically and racially charged situation with Roseanne Barr, didn't want to have to deal with it. And so they made the call. Obviously, Disney is a family-friendly oriented company. Obviously, Disney's all about branding and perception, and they didn't want to be tied to something like this. And so they made the call to remove Gunn from Guardians. Personally, I'm disappointed because you're kind of in a place where it doesn't matter how long ago the statements were, you're being held to account for them. And I think that discounts the idea of people changing or people's mindset changing or attitudes changing. And I think that, you know, we should allow for personal growth and personal change for people. And, you know, punishing someone financially and reputation-wise for something they said 8-9 years ago totally discounts the ability for them to have grown past that change or grown past those comments. I think there's going to be a generation of kids that are coming up, you know, kids who are 14, 15, 16 now, who when they get to 24, 25, 26, and they're trying to go out there in the job market, are going to be in a world of hurt because their entire life is posted on social media, on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And we're already living in a world where employers go back and look at your timeline and ask you about anything that is suspicious or might be damaging to the governor or damaging to whoever your employer happens to be. I think and that's with people who are in their 30s and 40s who, you know, social media hasn't been a huge presence in their life until later. Kids who've grown up with it, who spent their entire life on it, putting it out there to everybody, are going to be facing these kinds of consequences, and I think that that's a mistake. The other part, too, of this, and I'm not going to get into politics, but this was done out of a motivation for a political agenda. Gunn, as early as most recently as the Monday of Comic-Con week, was making comments about the President of the United States currently and making some retorts. And his retorts were not anything different from what the typical quote-unquote Hollywood liberal puts out there on Twitter every day. It's nothing different than something someone like, say, John Cusack or Jason Alexander put out there, just to name a couple. Certainly, it's nowhere near what Cusack is putting out there, but it caught enough of the attention and the ire of mainstream fringe conservatives, and they wanted their pound of flesh. And if you know anybody, we've all got skeletons in the closet. We've all got things that we really wish we wouldn't have said or wouldn't have done, or that we regret having said or we regret having done. And they found them. They went looking and they found them. And that's the way with any of us. If you go looking, you will find stuff. And I think that because of his political leaning, that this is in part being done, he was in part targeted because of his political leanings. And I think that's kind of unfair and unjust, especially in a society where we have the freedom of speech and we have people of the opposite opinion who get to go out there and say whatever they want to with impunity, but those on the other side don't get to and don't have that same right. And I think that that's a problematic place for dialogue. But then again, I think you could probably make the argument that our dialogue nationally has not been as respectful or positive as it needs to be. Long before political culture went that way, certainly internet commentary went that way. Nerds got pretty vicious pretty quickly. So Disney made this move. Now, what does it mean for Marvel? Well, it means that more than likely we're not going to get Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 in 2020. In May 2020. They might bump the movie to November 2020 to give them a little bit of time. But, they've only got Zoe Saldana and Dave Bautista and Bradley Cooper and Vin Diesel and Chris Pratt under contract for so much longer. When Chris Pratt signed that deal in 2013, he wasn't this Chris Pratt. He was still the chubby guy from Parks and Recs. Zoe Saldana was, still the blue girl from the first Avatar movie, and Uhura from Star Trek. Bradley Cooper and Vin Diesel just collect checks for voice work. But they're only going to have them under contract for one more film, and they're busy, busy, busy actors. I mean, Cooper's getting ready to go out there and with his directorial debut, a remake of A Star Is Born with Lady Gaga that is getting positive awards buzz for 2019. You've got Vin Diesel, of course, shooting more Fast and the Furious and XXX movies. You've got Pratt out there doing, still trying to do a Cowboy Ninja Viking movie, and also still has a Jurassic World 3 Rise of the Dinos to make. So you've got, and of course, Zoe Saldana is busy being blue down in Australia. So you have a lot of things going on, a lot of very busy actors. And chances are, as Feige said as recently as the press tour for Ant-Man and the Wasp, basically, they were getting ready to start pre-production in January, meaning, Gunn had tweeted out that he had published his script for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, and he had turned it in Memorial Day weekend. So where does this leave Marvel? Those actors are busy. They've only got them contracted for one more film. Guardians 3 was supposed to introduce Adam Warlock. We know that Gunn had an incredible amount of creative freedom on those films, and he was a huge part of the overall structure of plan for Disney going forward, for Marvel going forward in terms of what their galactic universe was going to look like, cosmic side of the universe was going to look like. We know that Gunn had gone out talking about a Ravagers movie or a Groot and Rocket spinoff movie. Neither one of those can happen now with Gunn. And the big question is, what are you going to do with Gunn's script? Yes, it's a first or second draft, but that franchise as a whole has his unique voice in it, and his voice is not going to be easy to replicate. And there are not a lot of directors who could just step right in and make great films with the Guardians. Gunn had a level of understanding and a depiction of those characters. He had a very heavy influence on their depiction in both Avengers 3 and Avengers 4. So, and obviously he was going to catch them coming off of those emotional films. So now Marvel has to start the process of pretty much starting over from scratch. And I say starting over from scratch because you can't... excuse me. You can't... I say starting over from scratch because you can't use any of Gunn's stuff, because Gunn, you'd have to pay Gunn for it, and Disney isn't going to want to have to be seen cutting a check to James Gunn for, you know, a couple of million bucks for a screenplay. They don't want to be seen doing that. So they're going to have to find new writers, and they're going to have to find a new director. And so now that conversation's going to begin. And I would expect that by the time October comes around, by the time we get to Halloween, that we would have a new director for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 announced. Probably about the time we start getting the first Avengers 4 trailer to drop. My personal feeling, and I put this out on Twitter, is that I feel like Nicole Perlman is the right answer for this gig. She wrote the original drafts for Guardians. She's credited as a co-writer on the original Guardians movie. She is the one who pitched Marvel an idea for how to do a Guardians of the Galaxy movie. She is the one who wrote the first couple of drafts. She's the one who helped formulate the ideas, and then Gunn came in and just took those ideas to another level. She has also been a co-writer on Captain Marvel as well as Inside Out, so she's very familiar with the Disney way. She has no directorial experience, but she has plenty of writing experience. She understands these characters. She understands this galaxy. She understands the way the Marvel machine works. And she's a female. And I think that if you hired a male and female team to do Captain Marvel, you haven't announced a true female director yet. We know that they're hired one for a Black Widow movie, but they haven't officially announced that, even though it's been in the trades. So I think Nicole Perlman is the right person for that job. You can't go get Taika. He's in the middle of doing his movie. The Russos are burned out, and quite frankly, I don't need to see another Russo Brothers Marvel movie for a little while. I want to see somebody with a new and interesting take. Favreau's in the middle, is an MCU player, but he's in the middle of, you know, all the technical work on his Lion King movie. So, you know, the number of people who could slip into that spot and fill it are very limited. And so, you know, I really am going to champion Nicole Perlman to take over that spot. But overall, it is extremely sad news that we have lost a great creative voice in the MCU, and that the MCU has, you know, is going to have to change, because all of the plans for the cosmic side of the universe are going to be gone. So let's move on to Saturday. And Saturday brings with it a whole bunch of news, because we got, as anticipated, the big boys of the convention, Warner Brothers. If you recall, on our preview podcast, Jim had said that he really thought that Warner Brothers and Sony would be the hits, and that they would be supplying the headlines that we would have coming out of Comic-Con and going into the next week. And he was right. So a lot to get to with the Warner Brothers panel. Let's start with Lego Movie 2. The footage that was shown was double the Chris Pratt. It doubled down on a lot of the humor that we liked from the first one. It doubled down on the characters we liked from the first one. It seems to be, you know, keeping in line with that fourth wall breaking part that we all enjoyed from the first film. Everybody's back from the voice cast, and we're adding the female characters, and it really looks to be fun, funny, and upbeat. That franchise, if you want to call it that, is struggling a little bit because Ninjago bombed. Lego Batman movie did really good money last February, but it didn't do as much money as the Lego movie. And so now the Lego movie is coming out too. The second part is coming out. And the question is it too long? Has it been too long since the two movies came out? And what is the reaction going to be to it? The reaction to the footage was overly positive, and interesting. So I really do think that there's some positive mojo that's going to come out of the Comic-Con panel for Lego Movie 2, the second part. The next thing that we want to talk about is Shazam, the DC stuff. So let's start with Shazam. I know a lot of people on the internet are kind of frowning at this because it does look very much like a kid's movie. But that inherently is the tone you're looking for from a Shazam movie. The character in and of itself lends itself to in an elevator pitch style, you know, Superman meets Big. And that's what you got from that trailer. You got a lot of humor, a lot of jokes, a lot of color, bright color palette. You got a lot of lightheartedness. You got a lot of fun. And, you know, this is something that the Wonder Woman movie did get right. For all the fact that it pretty much mirrors the first Avenger in terms of telling a present story and a past story and bringing the character into where they need to be in terms of the larger narrative, the movie does have heroics to it, which is something you can't really say about, you know, Man of Steel or Batman vs. Superman or even Justice League. There is something inherently heroic about these characters, and both Shazam and Aquaman play, and Wonder Woman play those up. I think we're seeing the first signs of the, you know, to use a DC term, the rebirth of this universe after the dearth of the deconstructionism that Nolan or that. That Snyder liked. And I think that the lightheartedness and the fun and the camp of all three of these films that they showed really goes a long way to enduring some goodwill. And in particular with Shazam, just the cute earnestness, obviously the guy that they've got playing the actual Shazam, obviously he's coming off a hugely successful directorial debut of his own. But the movie flows, the comedic timing works, the color works, the costume works. Basing it as an origin story with, you know, Iron Man 1 type testing for the power set, helping him to understand the power, seeing the villain in the one-on-one fighting, seeing the way the action scenes are going to be framed, the humor that's involved, the color, it radiates hope. And that, I think, was the whole notion or theme of this DC panel that they had, was hope. You know, we've left the Snyder part. You know, we've said on this podcast many times, they had to get through Justice League. They got through Justice League, and now they're going to go Shazam, Aquaman, Shazam, Wonder Woman, and, you know, and that's basically December, March, November of 1819. So, you know, if these three films hit, you can, because Momoa and Diana, because Momoa and Gadot have obviously already been in both Dawn of Justice and Justice League, you can keep them. If you want to keep the guy who they had as Victor Stone, and obviously you've hired John Francis Daly and them to do a lighthearted and fun Flash movie, whether that ends up being Flashpoint or not, I would err on the side of it not needing to be a Flashpoint movie. If over the course of the next 12 to 18 months, you can endure really a lot of goodwill with what you showed today, you know, this weekend, if that promise turns into be fulfilled, then, you know, you have the foundations to build to a Justice League 2. And you can still do, you can still do, you know, Darkseid, and you can do everything that you wanted to do. It just, you needed to find the right tone, and I think that what this weekend showed is that you have found that right tone. The Shazam movie looks fun. It looks entertaining. It doesn't look PG-13. It looks PG, but I'm sure there will be some things that make it PG-13. Just because, you know, there have been triple the number of PG-13 movies over the last 10 years than there have PG or even G movies. G movies are almost non-existent now. So, and I think that part of that is due to the MPAA being a little bit more restrictive. But overall, I think that we're looking at, you know, a really positive reaction for this Shazam stuff. Aquaman, I liked what I saw. I think James Gunn's going to bring an epic, amazing feel to this. And it's going to be goofy and it's going to be campy, but it's also going to be action-packed and adventurous. I like the idea of Mara basically having to bring the prodigal son home to take his rightful place and lead. I think one of my favorite lines in the trailer is, you know, Atlantis doesn't need a king, it needs something more than a king. And I like the duality of his two worlds, the world of the surface world and the underworld. I like the design of Black Mantis shooting lasers out of his eyes. The fact that we live in a world where in 2018 we can get away with doing something like that and having audiences accept it is wonderful. Because God knows that 18 years ago, we couldn't get yellow spandex suits on the X-Men. So, you know, I'm glad that we've advanced to a point where that can be a thing. The underwater shots, some of them, even though the CGI effects aren't really done yet, are breathtaking. And I think the scope that he has introduced here is kind of breathtaking in its totality. I think you're going to see some Thor parallels in terms of brother versus brother. I think you're going to see, probably more recently, some Black Panther parallels. You know, hidden city, outsider trying to come in and make his claim to the throne, king, reluctant king, or new king trying to maintain and establish his rule, trying to overcome a potential war. You know, I think there are going to be some challenges there, but the designs on the creatures look great. The designs on the characters look great. Momoa's timing, comedic timing, is good. The humor is a bit dude-ish. And by that, I'll give you a good example. Like, there's a scene in some of the extended footage that they show where Mara, you know, has a key to unlock this thing on the surface, and she tries to use it, but it doesn't work. And then she realizes that she needs some moisture, some water, to make the key work. And so she takes the sweat from the brow of from Curry's brow, and she holds it to the key, and she turns it, and opens it up. And you know, Aquaman and Curry makes the joke, well, you know, I could have peed on it. I mean, that's the kind of bro humor I'm talking about. You know, when he bursts through the top of the submarine and, you know, permission to come aboard, and it's like that kind of dude-ish humor, which we saw some of in Justice League. I think it's going to be interesting to see how that tone and that style plays you know, to a broader audience. So I liked what I saw. I'm hopeful for what James Wan's gonna do. I really do have great hopes for what he can accomplish, and I think that if he can, you know, do the impossible and make an Aquaman movie awesome, he'll be able to write whatever check he wants to cash. I know that we did get the announcement of The Conjuring 3 coming forward from him, which is going to be interesting to see. Now, following that, we got the Wonder Woman footage. It was very brief. They've only been shooting for a little while, but it definitely had an 80s vibe to it. it definitely dipped its toe in nostalgia, definitely placed it in a Cold War environment, and gave us just more goofy, off-the-wall humor and bright color palette, and a Diana Prince who is likable and lovable. You can say what you want to about all the doubts we had 4 years ago about Gal Gadot being able to pull this off. She has 16 lines of Dawn of Justice and steals the show. She owns her own movie, and she has a decent impact in the choppiness of Justice League. So, I mean, she is a prime time player in this industry and in this genre, and a perfect fit for the role. And I think that, you know, she's only going to get better with time and with appearances, and I really think Wonder Woman 2 has an opportunity to be something really, really special, the way that Winter Soldier was something really, really special for Captain America's second outing. So that concluded the DC portion of things. The next thing I want to really move to is Fantastic Beasts. Now, Jim was kind of hesitant about whether or not Fantastic Beasts would go to Comic-Con. They did indeed show up. And they showed up in full force, and they showed up with Johnny Depp in tow. I don't think he spoke very much, but he was there, and that was, I think, kind of a jaw-dropping moment. Considering you were in an environment where James Gunn had just been fired for comments he had made in 2010 or 2009, to see Depp there and to hear him speak on a role that, you know, again, it's gone completely different from what I thought it would be. I mean, when I read the books, I did not picture Gorlek Grindelwald looking that way. I always thought that he had the same appeal and the same charm that Voldemort had. That Tom Riddle charmed his way to many of the Horcruxes as he went. There was a reason why he started out as a shopkeeper's errand boy, going to collect and talk people into donating various family trinkets and treasures to the store. And that was because he was a smooth-talking, good-looking gentleman. And that was part of the issue with Hagrid. Hagrid was this big, burly dude. And, you know, it was easy enough to frame him up for using the opening the chamber when, you know, who's going to suspect that the dashing head boy of Slytherin is actually, you know, a Parseltongue, who is a descendant of Slytherin. But be that as it may, I think one of the things that we need to point out about this trailer is the fact that they are leaning heavy on something they weren't leaning on in the first film. They were very much kind of trying to lean into the parts of the franchise you don't know. They were very much trying to lean into the fact that this was a new world, a new part of the Wizarding World, that this movie took place in a different time period, that it was going to take place in America, and you could see the American side of things, and this zoologist was going to come to the forefront, and you really didn't know his story. All you knew is that he wrote a book. And that was the whole point of the charm. It was supposed to kind of be this ancillary universe, or ancillary part of the universe, or story. The problem is that movie didn't make a lot of money. So what Rowling has done in Crimes of Grindelwald is basically give you everything you didn't get in the first Fantastic Beasts. You're going to get Hogwarts. Look, people, there's a reason that they've stuck Hogwarts front and center of both trailers now. There's a reason you see kids in robes with wands and Dumbledore teaching. There's a reason why you're seeing young Dumbledore. There's a reason why at the end of the trailer, you get a guy that you meet an alchemist named Nicholas Flamel. Because Nicholas Flamel and Grindelwald and the Sorcerer's Stone, that's all part of the Harry Potter lineage. Harry Potter fans know when they hear the name Nicholas Flamel, they know who that is, and they know that he created the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone, which was the whole heart of the first film of the Harry Potter franchise. So they are going to lean heavy on giving you what you didn't get in the first movie. Newt's going to interact with Dumbledore. Newt's going to go back to Hogwarts. Newt's going to go to Paris. Newt's going to end up at Beauxbatons, because we see the Pegasus coaches being utilized. And we also know that we went to the American Ministry of Magic type thing, the Congress, the Magical Congress in America. So we know that, you know, going to France, we will see Beauxbatons, and we will see, you know, the Wizarding School from there that we didn't get to see in Goblet of Fire. So they do a really good job with this trailer, leaning into the fact that you're going to get all of the things you didn't get, and you're going to get more backstory on Tina this woman that Newt loved, that, you know, he saw, had the picture stowed away, and her last name was Lestrange, or Lestrange, which, of course, ties into Bellatrix Lestrange and that whole wizarding family, Sirius Black, and that whole deal. I love the one line that she has in the trailer is, you know, you never met that's the problem with you, Newt, you never met a monster you didn't love. And we know that Ezra Miller's conscience his character Cadence or whatever his name was, that he's going to show back up. I think that Rowling's writing is going to get stronger. I think these visuals are very epic and very inviting. I think this is very much giving you the sense of returning to the Wizarding World. We didn't really get that sense in Fantastic Beasts. You're definitely going to get it in Crimes of Grindelwald. And we know that there's two more movies coming after this. So if this movie makes more than the first, which I think it will, just based on the fact that you have young Dumbledore, you have Hogwarts, you have all these different elements, Nicholas Flamel, that I think you're going to get a bigger number. So I really felt invigorated and really energized by the Nicholas Flamel reveal coming out of their Comic-Con panel. Obviously, the panel itself didn't bring a whole lot of surprises, but the footage certainly did. So that moves us to the final thing that I want to talk about in regards to Comic-Con 2018. And that would, of course, be Godzilla. I talked on our preview podcast about how badly I needed this trailer. And boy, howdy, did it supply exactly what I wanted and everything I needed and everything I didn't know I wanted. This is an extreme departure from Gareth's vision. Gareth's movie is a fairly limited movie. You find Godzilla, comes out of the water, the Mutos are found, the Mutos get loose, the Mutos crawl their way across Vegas and other places, making their way to San Francisco. Godzilla traces across the Pacific, has a meeting with the Muto in Hawaii, and then ultimately has the ultimate showdown with the Muto in San Francisco. Now, that movie's final battle, which is what, you know, they play peekaboo with Godzilla till you get to the final battle, that movie's final battle is set in San Francisco. And it's very much contained to downtown San Francisco. And we see at the end of the movie, Godzilla going back into the water. And we know from the panel that Michael Dougherty, said that basically this film is a reaction to the first film, that once they realize that these gods live among us, basically, they start getting concerned about, you know, Godzilla, friend or foe. It's really not any different than the idea of superheroes being a thing in the universe and the Sokovia Accords and the, you know, the realistic, what would happen if superheroes were a real thing? You'd have the Mutant Registration Act, or you'd have the Sokovia Accords. Governments would be freaked out, and they'd be trying to regulate them. And Dougherty has said that we're going to get some of that. The problem is, every bit of footage that we saw from this movie indicated a post-apocalyptic society. Like, we went from beautiful downtown San Francisco that, you know, had a few buildings wrecked, but he could really, you know, fix it, to, like, Washington, D.C. burning in a pile of ash. And, you know, people in underground bunkers and in radiation suits. And, you know, and a woman talking about how if we don't find all the Titans in time, then our world's going to be destroyed, with no real indication of how our world is being destroyed. It's a really, really, really far jump from where Gareth is at the end of Godzilla to the 5 years, because this is, because of course the movie's going to come out in May of 19. Gareth's movie was May of 14, so they're using real time. So they're saying that this movie takes place 5 years after the original. In those 5 years, apparently a lot has gone to shit. So how they get to that devastating point is going to be really interesting to me. Now, we know from the post-credit stinger to Kong Skull Island that they have known about the existence of King Ghidorah, Mothra, and Rodan since the 70s. Since the late 60s, early 70s. So, now that Monarch is a known quantity, because, you know, of course, they were the ones having to give testimony about who these things were and what they were, and they had to come out of the shadows and get government funding after Godzilla went back into the water. That, you know, Monarch is trying to now, for some reason, hunt down these Titans and release them. For what purpose, we have no idea. The footage itself looks epic. This looks like the grandest, biggest, most awesome Godzilla movie you could ever think of. The designs on these creatures look immense. They look big. They look broad. They look towering. And all of them look Toho accurate. Some of the news that we got from Dougherty was that indeed, you know, they are going to meet more monsters, not just Mothra, Rodan, and King Ghidorah. That Godzilla will have to have both friends and foes. And that there will be what are called breadcrumbs that lead to Kong. My question is, Kong at the end of Kong Skull Island was still left on Skull Island. He wasn't taken back to the city the way that the legend normally would dictate that he is. So how does, and if this is a post-apocalyptic world, what the hell, you know, happened? Did Skull Island just get, you know, passed over for the apocalypse? I mean, what happened there? So those are some questions that I have, but overall, man, I am way pumped about this Godzilla trailer. This makes me want this movie tomorrow, and it gives me a great hope for the kind of epic action we can expect from Kong versus Godzilla come 2020, a movie that is now starting to cast, which is in and of itself pretty amazing. So could not be more happy. That was the thing I was happiest about coming out of Comic-Con. So there you have it. There's all the information that we gleaned from Comic-Con 2018. Our thoughts, our feelings, my thoughts, my feelings, my emotions, heading into the fall season and as we get into award movies and prestige pictures and, of course, the holiday rush. We look very much forward to the second half of 2018 and all the movies and adventures that we can go on. And we look forward to seeing more from a lot of these movies that we that we've talked about here this evening. The bit of surprising box office news was that Equalizer 2, the sequel to a movie that came out in August of 2016, I want to say, did big business and did it. Enough business to overpower the disappointing Mamma Mia sequel, which may have the original creative force behind it, but was not awesome. The journeys of mother and daughter don't align. The stories that you're telling of mother and daughter are at different points in their lives. They don't converge until very late, and even when they converge very late, they converge in a very tangential manner. Their Cher is obnoxious and unneeded, and her character is stupid and silly, and it's just an excuse for Cher to have a song, basically. Andy Garcia's character is not well served by his surprise twist. And, you know, there are not a lot of ABBA songs. It's really just, you know, Dancing Queen, and that's it. There's not a single moment, there's not a single song in this version of Mamma Mia that moves you as powerfully as either Dancing Queen in the original or Those Were the Days, My Friend, in the original. So really, really disappointed in the failure there, and I'm really hopeful that, I'm surprised that Equalizer was able to win. But then again, I guess it really shouldn't have been because, you know, Denzel is one of the few last true movie stars who can open a movie. So that's our box office recap for the weekend. We look forward to many more movies coming out, and we look forward to sharing more weird, wild, and wacky weeks of movie news with you. So until next time, I'm Brian C. Wood. You can follow me on Twitter at BCWTigerFan. You can follow Chad at The Mets Theory and T Bob Hebert at T Bob 53 and Jim Vavida, excellent as always, at Jim Vavida. I'd also mention Terry Schwartz at Terry Schwartz underscore Schwartz. Thank you very much and have a pleasant evening.